Part 29, Chapter 1. The next 2 days were the most horrible in Johnny's life. Cage, drone, and all. Stormlong had simply flown into thin air and vanished. He didn't answer on radio, even when Johnny said his name in clear. The bank office in Luxembourg was open and answering, but there was just a girl there, and she didn't speak any tongue anyone at Kariba could speak. French? And even though they said McAdam, and she tried to tell them something back, they couldn't make it out. Johnny could not leave here. The emissaries in the conference room would go in and out. They were working on and on with the trial. They didn't pay much attention to him. Johnny slept in the ops room and only got out when Chief Chongwan would spell him for a few minutes by standing in case anything urgent came through. Truth told, there was not too much coming through that Johnny had to handle. Even had he gotten urgent requests, he couldn't have done anything about them, for he had no available pilots, troops, or defense forces. He was actually the only one defending the planet. The woman, Tinny, was lots of help, but there was a limit to the number of hours anyone could stay awake, even a Buddhist nun. Angus was spending some time with the transshipment rig. He had left the gyro cage on a Tolnep mountain to learn the full fate of the moon, Asart.
I wanted to see whether there were earthquakes on Tolnep,
he told Johnny.
When you change mass in a system, you could expect changes in gravitational stresses. I read someplace that if our own moon got knocked out into space or something, it would cause earthquakes here. But Tolnep didn't shake up our gyro cage.
A few hours later, Johnny had heard a motor running in the bowl and, edgy, had gone out to check. Angus was running a blade scraper. He was pushing a huge piece of the capital ship through the undergable entrance. It was a piece that had hit the shore. Chief Chongwan was very sharp with him, for it was scraping up the pavement, and Chief Chongwan had no men to repair the scars. Angus said something about wanting to see whether the ultimate bomb were still active.
Well, don't bring anything back here that touches that area,
said Johnny, and went back in to answer a radio query. The next morning, Angus had come in to eat a bowl of noodles with him and tell him about it.
I put that scrap metal way out beyond the set. I thought it would fall through the gas.
What gas?
Oh, Asart just seems to be gas now. Just a huge cloud of gas. It was blackish for a while, but then it cleared up. You can see it is a cloud of gas, but you can see through it. It's pretty obvious now why the cyclones never used that bomb. As mining people, they needed metal, not gas.
So what happened to the scrap iron?
I thought it would fall through the gas and go on down and hit the surface at Tolnep. It didn't. It fell all right, but it just went to the center of the gas cloud, and it's still there. Want to see a picture of it?
Just don't fire into that cloud and bring any of that stuff back here on recoil.
I won't,
promised Angus.
But what I believe is, once that ultimate bomb converted everything to gas, it went null. It doesn't have anything to work on, and the reaction isn't self-starting again once it's complete. The metal trace says that it's all very low-order gases now. Hydrogen.
Then the ultimate bomb brings about low-order fission. It stimulates a split of the atoms of heavier metals. I'm no expert, but that's what it seems you're describing.
Anyway, all I'm trying to tell you is that the mass of the moon didn't change, so far as gravitic influence is concerned. In that coldness, the resulting gas has kind of gone liquid, and the moon is a sort of bubble with a much bigger diameter. I think you could fly through it.
Great. Don't.
Angus finished up his noodles.
I just thought you'd like to know that destroying that moon won't upset our coordinate tables. A shift of mass could throw every coordinate out eventually.
Ah, you do have a point. That was clever of you.
Angus thought so, too. But news from other areas was not so encouraging. It was not that anything bad was adding up. It was just the non-existence of news so far as the fate of Chrissy and the people in Scotland was concerned, and the fate of his people in the Russian base. They had found the chief of Clan Fergus outside, very close to death, and after emergency transfusions, had rushed him up to the old underground hospital in Aberdeen. There was not much hope. They had drilled holes through rubble that blocked the tunnels, and they hoped they had gotten air hoses into the shelters. There were rumors they had heard voices, but there had been no mine radios in those shelter areas to begin with, and you couldn't tell much while trying to shout down an air hose, pumps running and all. The city was just towers of smoke, as was Castle Rock. They were having a terrible time trying to open the approach tunnels, working around the clock. The Russian base news was not much better. They had put the surface coal fires out, but the mine was burning underground, and they did not know whether it was reaching the actual levels of the base. The huge doors were so warped they could not be opened even with burning torches, and they were now driving in a brand new entrance to bypass them, adrift through solid rock, working over ground that was still burning under them, down deep. The ventilator shafts were too tortuous and too barred with armor and filter to be of any use. To add to the tension in Kariba, the original small gray man, Dries Glatten, had vanished. The one anti-aircraft gunner on duty said that the man had simply come out about dawn, ordered a new set of signal lights and radio beacon signals near where his ship was parked, and sailed off, wham, into the sky, and they couldn't even track where he had gone to. The lights were out there now, two reds flashing, and the radio beacon was telling all ships to stay clear from a conference area. Lord Voraz, when asked, had shrugged and said it probably came under the heading of prerogatives of a branch manager, and was probably bank business, and he had gone on eating the perpetual bites between meals the cook served him up. He was no help. But what gave Johnny a shock in those 2 days was the sudden arrival of Captain Roger Dieter Snowell. The conference had called him in as a witness, and they didn't tell Johnny, and didn't tell the anti-aircraft gunner. The first Johnny knew of it was the anti-aircraft gun going off. Lord Dom came rolling into operations like a liquid jellyfish, roaring and rumbling to cease fire. Johnny got the gunner to quit. Fortunately, it had been at very extreme range, and Angus had not been using the rig. But Roger Dieter Snowell, omitting to ask permission to land a small launch craft, almost got himself shot down.
"He's been called as a witness!"
shouted Lord Dom.
"Don't you know there's a trial going on?"
Trial or no trial, Johnny stuck a Smith & Wesson with thermite bullets in his belt and plugs in his ears, and went out to personally calm the launch craft down with a hand radio and make sure the Tolnep remained blind to their defenselessness. Suppressing an urge to shoot Roger Dieter on sight, he limited himself to confiscating his vision filter, making sure the Tolnep had no spare, and personally escorting him to the conference room. He left the Tolnep there, but told them that when they were through with him, they better call ops to escort him out, because Roger Dieter was going to be stone blind all the time he was around Kariba. About 5 hours later, they did call him again, and he collected Roger Dieter and guided him out to the launch craft. But before he gave him back the filter faceplate, he had Chief Chongwan smear the inside of the launch craft dome with black water ink. Whether Roger Dieter complained or not that he would have to wipe holes in it somehow to find his orbiting ship was unknown to Johnny. He still had his earplugs in. Johnny gave Roger Dieter back the filter for his eyes, and from the look of his mouth, the Tolnep, staring at him, said,
"You!"
So Johnny said,
"Me. And just as a personal goodbye, the next time I see you on this planet's surface, you won't like it at all. So get the hell out of here."
And slammed the canopy down on him. When the launch craft was gone, Johnny took the earplugs out and found that the single anti-aircraft gunner had been begging him for 10 minutes for permission to accidentally shoot the ship down. Johnny sympathized with him. He felt the same way himself. And still, not a whisper from Stormalong. And not a bit of sense from Luxembourg. No word of Chrissy. No word of his village people. No word of his friends. It was a horrible 2 days. In action, he was finding, was a far, far heavier load than the whirlwind existence to which he was accustomed. He was nearing a breaking point of apprehension for the people and planet he had fought so long to save. At 8 that night, it didn't make things any better to be stopped by Lord Voraz, who offered him a job at 50,000 credits a year to come to the Greedides system and make teleportation consoles for the bank for the rest of his life. Johnny had to walk away quickly to keep from becoming violent. A very horrible 2 days.